Hello, the purpose of this podcast is to talk about the overlap between equity and finance. Equity as a word is an important component of finance theory. Doesn't mean the same thing as it does to a lawyer. To a finance theorist, it refers to shares in a company primarily, and also covers derivatives in relation to such shares. Shares and derivatives are examples of securities. And wrapping that all up together with other forms of securities, we have to include things like bonds. I write a lot on securities law. I write a lot on the law on financial derivatives. So for me, there's an overlap between that and the other work I do in equity. What I want to do, though, in this particular podcast about the overlap between equity and finance is to show an area in which there is now a close linkage between financial regulation and concepts of equity, and another area in which there seems to be a great slippage and equity is lagging some way behind. Bankers Trust and Damala, for example, Mr. Justice Mance was asked to consider the behaviour of Bankers Trust in relation to one of its clients, Damala, which was an Indonesian financial institution. And the claims that had been made was that Bankers Trust had committed all sorts of acts of fraud, misrepresentation, undue influence, duress, unconscionability and so forth. Ultimately, Mr. Justice Mance found that all of these allegations were unfounded. In deciding the question, how would he know whether or not a bank like Bankers Trust had acted in those ways, Mr. Justice Mance decided that what he should do is to look at the applicable financial regulations setting out the standards which Bankers Trust should have observed. And at the time, this was the so-called Bank of England Grey Code, or Bank of England London Code. Now, what this means is we have a very interesting cross-fertilisation between the norms of substantive law, whether or not someone's acted reasonably at common law, conscionably in equity, and so on and so forth, and the norms of financial regulation. This, for me, is going to be the roots of the development of a meaningful area which we will know as the law of finance. And this is the basis on which I'm writing a textbook called The Law of Finance, even as we speak. So in other cases like Cowander Group Properties and Eagle Trust, we see Mr. Justice Knox asked a question about whether or not the defendant had acted with knowledge, whether the defendant had acted unconscionably, deciding that the question must be answered by reference to whether or not the defendant had behaved in a commercially reasonable manner, quote unquote. In other words, what Mr. Justice Knox was doing was saying an objective statement as to whether or not this defendant has behaved properly, because this defendant is a commercial person, requires us to look at what would constitute reasonable commercial behaviour in that context. So that doesn't even necessarily require that there are official regulations. It might simply mean that in relation to that particular marketplace, we can take evidence as to what a regular participant ought to have done in that market. Similarly, in Manolakaki and Konstantinides, Mr. Justice Smith is asked to consider whether or not solicitors have acted honestly or conscionably in advising one of their clients as to the investments that that client should make. Mr. Justice Smith held that in deciding how those solicitors should have behaved, he would look not at specific regulations issued by the law society which governed those solicitors, but that he would look at mere guidance notes which the law society had generated. In other words, those guidance notes would stand for an objective statement as to what those solicitors should and should not have done. What I'm suggesting is this is going to become a very important part of the law of finance in the future, because for the law of finance, we need to know how do these central concepts of substantive law apply in the particular context of finance. And the answer to that question seems to be you look at what constitutes commercially reasonable conduct, or you look at what is required by regulation in that particular context, and that states what those objective standards are. And so I discuss this issue in detail in my book Securities Law, published in April 2008. particularly by reference to Financial Services Authority or FSA rule books. Now, there are other areas of substantive law which seem to be lagging far behind where these regulatory principles have gone. So, for example, cases like Armitage and Nurse tell us that it is acceptable for trustees to exclude their liabilities in the trust instrument for anything up to and including gross negligence, and that trustees cannot exclude their liability in the trust instrument for dishonesty. Now, this is true, it seems, then, of trusts generally. But what's interesting is that all the statutes relating to trustees of particular kinds, for example, trustees in relation to unit trusts, in Section 237 of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, in relation to Section 33 and 35 of the Pensions Act of 1995, we see that trustees are not permitted in those contexts to exclude their liabilities. As soon as we have regulatory schemes introduced in relation to particular kinds of trust, the statute always prevents those trustees from excluding their liabilities, because that would be to the detriment of beneficiaries in those contexts. In Polypeck and Nadir, Lord Justice Scott held that there was no obligation on a bank, in that case the Central Bank of Northern Cyprus, to investigate the sources of funds that were being paid to it. In that case, it's alleged that Azal Nadir had taken about £46 million out of the Polypeck group of companies in breach of his fiduciary duties. It was said by Lord Justice Scott that there was no positive obligation on the bank to inquire into the sources of those funds, and therefore that because there was no obligation to inquire into the sources of those funds, and because there was nothing otherwise about the transaction, said Lord Justice Scott, that meant the bank ought to have been suspicious, it was said, therefore, that the bank would not be treated as having knowledge of those breaches of fiduciary duty. Now, this is an odd one, I would suggest, precisely because banking law does impose positive obligations on bankers in such circumstances under English law. Thus, money laundering regulation, criminal justice acts require that bankers inquire into the source of payments and that they report suspicious payments to the authorities. Under FSA regulation, there is a requirement under the Conduct of Business Rules that banks do a form of due diligence on their customers to identify, amongst other things, their level of investment expertise and so on and so forth. Now, taken in tandem with money laundering regulation, this imposes positive obligations on banks. In other words, the substantive law ought to be accepting that bankers do bear these positive obligations to inquire into certain matters, and that therefore they ought to be deemed to have knowledge of the things they would have found out if they had lived up to those obligations, and that otherwise they are willfully shutting their eyes to the obvious, or willfully failing to make the inquiries that an honest and reasonable banker should have made. So, it's also a feature of FSA regulation now, under the Principles for Businesses rulebook, that all authorised persons are required to act with integrity. And I would suggest that this is a great intellectual link between equity on the one hand, with its idea that you must act in good conscience, and on the other hand, the law of finance developing an idea that one must act with integrity if you're regulated by the Financial Services Authority. It seems to me the only difference is hundreds of years of jurisprudence. In equity, we have developed what is meant by this idea of good conscience in various contexts. And I think the law of finance now has that work to do in deciding what it means to act with integrity. How does that react, for example, to contexts where there are conflicts of interest, context where there may be inside information, and so on and so forth. The parameters of many of those debates are already created by statute in the finance law world. But I think using them to develop an idea of what constitutes integrity will be key to the emerging jurisprudence of the law of finance. I think that will end this podcast. That gives you the roots of those particular ideas. These are ideas I'll be discussing in detail in my textbook, The Law of Finance, which is to be published in 2009. the yelping and screaming you can possibly hear in the background is Bauhaus's final concert, which I put on the CD, and which is a little bit louder than I expected. Thank you for your kind attention.